Thank you. Okay, well, this talk is based on the paper that I wrote with Steve. Is Steve here? Steve? Oh, good. I can explain how. Never mind.
Remember, this is being recorded.
That's right. Well, that's why I stopped, right? Okay, so it came as a big surprise to me. I'm sure it was well understood by all string experts, but it came as a big surprise to me when I, which was some years ago, when I first realized that in string theory, even in weakly coupled string theory and critical number of dimensions, you could not actually calculate the scattering cross-section at arbitrarily high energies. Because at arbitrarily high energies, you might make a black hole, and that's a non-perturbative process in string theory, and you don't know how to calculate it. So I'm still annoyed by that. It just seems wrong to me that, you know, the theory is supposed to be the ultraviolet completion, blah, 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 and can't actually calculate. So we still don't know how to calculate. I don't know how to calculate, but I do know how to guess. So this talk is going to mostly be about a guess as to what the scattering, the exclusive 2-to-2 scattering cross-section should be like. And well, you'll be able to judge for yourselves whether the guess is reasonable or unreasonable, and what, if anything, can be done to check it. Okay, so so there are various length scales, as you all know, that come into these things. There's the d-dimensional Planck length, which is the d-dimensional Newton's constant, the power of 1 over d minus 2. There's the string scale. Alpha prime with the 1/2. And these are, in general, different, and they're related by some power of the coupling constant that I don't remember. But the important point is that in weakly coupled string theory, the Planck length is much smaller than the string length. And so the problems where we have trouble understanding what's going on come at super Planckian energies. Where the center of mass energy in some scattering experiment is much greater than the d-dimensional Planck mass, which is, of course, 1 over d-dimensional the Planck length. Another way to say this, which is suggestive, is that this happens when the Schrodinger radius for a black hole with this energy is much greater than the d-dimensional Planck length. So the other important length scale in a scattering experiment, so the Schrodinger length, this should go somewhere on the list of length scales. Another important length scale is the impact parameter. Which you, you know, from when you're doing scattering, you send in a particle, your impact parameter is the perpendicular, classically speaking, is the perpendicular distance by which the particle passes by whatever you're scattering off of, modulo some factor of 2 for converting to center of mass frame, which I never get right. And roughly speaking, the impact parameter can be thought of as the angular momentum, which I'll write as script L, divided by the energy. And that's just because in this simple classical picture, if you calculate the angular momentum, you're just going to get P times B from this. And we're assuming relativistic energies, so this is the same as E times B. So that's
D. What's D? Is D the
dimension? D is the number of space-time dimensions.
But is that in the theory, or where the scattering experiment's being carried out?
Well, it's going to be both, because I'm only going to think about theories with no compactified dimensions. But if you want to make a distinction, it's going to be the number of dimensions where the scattering is carried out.
Four.
Okay. Four is going to be bad for a variety of reasons, because there are going to be some D minus fours that appear in some of these formulas, and that will be annoying. But, yes.
So are you saying that if the energy is Planckian but not super Planckian, we know how to calculate it?
No. Well, you know, the...
Or is it just you're going to focus on that?
No, I just want to focus on the super Planckian energy. As you approach the Planck energy, you lose the ability to calculate. Okay, so, well, I should qualify that, which I'm about to do, because I'm about to contradict myself by saying it also depends on the impact parameter, because if you have a sufficiently large impact parameter, you may still be able to calculate even at super Planckian energies. Well, we'll explore exactly what that means in it.
I guess my question is, what's worse in terms of what we know how to calculate, super Planckian or Planckian?
Super Planckian.
It's worse.
Yeah. No?
There are some things that are better.
Yeah.
Because there's a semi-classical approximation.
Yes, right. Good point.
What's a large impact parameter?
What's
well, in a sense, an impact parameter of order one, it's an impact parameter of at least bigger.
No, there's a sense in which it works at small impact parameter. Namely, if you have a zero impact parameter, high energies, you have a semi-classical description where you form a black hole and you understand controllably some features of its evolution, although not all.
Yeah, but then you get the forward scattering amplitude is zero.
There'll be many opportunities to intersect remarks of this type, to interject remarks of this type as we go on. Okay, so I want to pick out two regimes of impact parameter. One is where you have a large impact parameter compared to the Schwarzschild radius. And in this regime, there you can do, and depending exactly where you are, you can do either just a simple Coulomb approximation to the scattering, or a somewhat souped-up version of it through the Iconal approximation. And there are some arguments that this should be the right answer, although I don't think they're quite definitive. But can at least get a handle on it. And the other regime, where the impact parameter is smaller than the Schwarzschild regime, is where we're in the strong gravity regime and really don't know what we're doing.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
We're doing classical calculations, I can understand what we get, but if you're doing quantum calculations, you have to worry a little bit about the fact that even in the Iconal approximation, you will get infrared emission.
Yes, you do. And that's another reason to be in higher dimensions, because the higher dimension you're in, the less bad is the infrared problem.
Okay.
Although it's even then, you still have to worry about it to some extent. Okay. So this division in terms of impact parameter is going to be very important. And it will also be useful to cast it in terms of angular momentum using this relation. So there's going to be a critical angular momentum, the word critical being used very loosely, that divides these two regimes which is of order the energy times the Schwarzschild radius, which is just given in terms of the energy. So this formula and, of course, many people have done a lot of work on string scattering over the years. Gabriel Veneziano was in town a few weeks ago and spoke about this. And he and his group, Amati, Ciafaloni, and Veneziano, like to draw this diagram, which is useful. So I'm going to think of parameterizing the scattering in terms of the Schwarzschild radius that corresponding to that energy. So this is really an energy axis, but written in terms of the Schwarzschild radius and the impact parameter. And then on these two axes, we can mark off the string length and the d-dimensional Planck length, which in weakly coupled string theory are different. And then there are several regimes. There's a stringy regime. When you're below the string scale in both impact parameter and energy, up here at large impact parameter is the Coulomb biconal regime. And over here is the strong gravity regime, which is the mysterious region on which there is very little that can be said definitely. So I'm not going to talk about anything that other people have done on the stringy regime. Steve has done a lot of work on that. David Gross has done a lot of work on that. There's a famous paper by Gross and Mende from a number of years ago using string methods. But I do want to talk briefly about the Coulomb biconal regime. It's somewhat interesting in its own right, and it will also help set things up to talk about the strong gravity regime. And the problem I want to talk about is just 2-to-2 particle elastic scattering. And I want to focus on this process mainly because it will hopefully be simple enough that it will allow us to say concrete things, or at least conjecture concrete things. And you will all remember from your quantum mechanics class partial wave expansions, where you do non-relativistic scattering and you write the outgoing wave function in terms of angular momentum eigenstates. Although it's not usually treated in field theory these days, there's a completely equivalent approximation in the relativistic quantum field theory version, and one can write down a partial wave expansion for a scattering amplitude. For the two-particle scattering amplitude, which we think of as a function of the usual Mandelstam variables S and T. I guess I should say somewhere that S is the center of mass energy squared, and T is related to the center of mass scattering angle. Anyway, so we can now write down a partial wave expansion in any number of dimensions, which looks like this. Okay, and here lambda is a parameter which is just d minus 3 over 2. let's see, I already said what S and T are. These things are Gegenbauer polynomials, which are generalizations of Legendre polynomials in four dimensions. And there's some horrible dimension-dependent prefactor here, which I think half our time was spent trying to figure out what all those prefactors were. Anyway, so that's just a standard partial wave expansion. And one nice thing about a partial wave expansion is it's easy to say what unitarity means for this amplitude in terms of these coefficients. Unitarity says that the imaginary part of F has to be greater than or equal to the absolute square of that. Which is, again, exactly the same thing that happens in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And then one can parameterize the result in terms of a partial wave phase shift delta, and inelastic production parameter. If beta is zero, then this holds an equality, and you're not producing any other particles, or the amplitude to produce other particles is zero. Beta has to be positive. If beta is non-zero, then you have the possibility of producing some other particles. And another way to express this is by an Argand diagram. Where we draw the real and imaginary parts of F as a circle of radius a half centered on I over 2. F has to lie somewhere inside this circle or on the circle if beta is zero. Okay. Oh, and finally, this formula can be inverted. If somebody gives you this, you can invert this using orthogonality of the Gegenbauer polynomials with a suitable integral to get the coefficient.
So Mark, everything here you said is independent of the theory?
Yeah, everything. Well, I'm assuming the incoming particles have zero spin. If they have spin, then of course there's a spin matrix aspect to this. So I'm ignoring all that. But for spin zero particles, this is completely general.
Spin just gets replaced by helicity amplitudes.
Well, it's more complicated because you can have spin flips, so it generally. Well. Yeah. Yeah, it yeah, you're right. It basically gets replaced by helicity. So the Iconal approximation is something that people try to apply when theta is much less than 1, and you imagine your two particles that you're scattering are coming in, and then you're exchanging gravitons or whatever, and the Iconal approximation can be expressed as a sum of ladder and cross-ladder graphs. So you allow basically arbitrary exchanges between your two scattered particles, but you don't allow anything to happen in between. So this is not a vertex here. This line is skipping over this line. And there are various arguments in the literature that say that this is, in fact, the leading contribution at small theta. It's not completely clear to me that those arguments are definitive. Maybe Steve disagrees with that, but.
Leading in what?
Sorry?
Leading in what parameter?
It's theta.
Oh,
data.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's been proven, but there are checks on that. But...
Yeah. Well, I.
Sort of, including matching it up with the Eichelberg-Sexel.
Yes.
Geometry and so on.
Right. So there are reasons to believe it's true, but you know, it's not, doesn't have the status of someone's really dotted all the I's, I think. It's not going to matter because we're not going to go beyond it anyway. So you can also attempt to soup it up by doing a better job on the propagators. So a lot of Veneziano and friends' string work has talked about using souped-up, regiized propagators here, where you don't just have a graviton exchange, you have a whole tower of states exchange, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one thing you can definitely do to improve it, if you know what your theory is and you know how to use improved propagators here. We're just going to use completely unimproved graviton propagators, and then there's a relatively simple formula which was worked out by Musenich and Soldate 20 years ago, I think. And there's a physical picture that involves looking at Fourier transforming the transverse momentum, so the momentum in the d minus 2 transverse directions to a particle path, Fourier transforming that to position space, summing up Coulomb amplitudes or whatever, summing up tree amplitudes, I should say, and then Fourier transforming back, and one gets a, at the end of the day, you end up with a formula that looks like this, where this Q perpendicular, so X perpendicular is getting integrated over Q perpendicular, has a magnitude that's related. So this is just like a transverse momentum that's pointing out of the pointing in the transverse plane perpendicular to the direction of motion with an angle sine theta, and that theta is supposed to be identified with the theta that goes into t, which is related by a slightly different formula. So really these are not quite the same thetas, but theta is small, so it doesn't matter, et cetera, et cetera. And let's see, the main thing is this iconal phase, for which there's another formula. This is now, we're going to take the original tree amplitude and think of t as minus a perpendicular momentum squared. We're going to Fourier transform that to this perpendicular position space, and then it turns out that summing up these diagrams essentially exponentiates this, and after we exponentiate it, we Fourier transform it back. So
was this calculated in general relativity?
It's not, it doesn't really matter very much what the propagators and vertices are here.
Oh, it doesn't depend on the
No, it, this is just a statement that if I give you this diagram, right, which gives you the tree amplitude.
I see.
Okay. Now, if I want to sum up this set of diagrams, this is the answer. At least if these, this is not too funny a propagator here. I mean, there's some standard propagator that goes. So, I'm assuming this is a spin zero particle anyway, and then this is the answer. So the tree amplitude we want to put here is the graviton tree amplitude, which is after much effort, we decided the coefficient was 8 pi that goes there in any number of dimensions, s squared over t.
There's nothing settled by going to a spin 2 particle in there.
Sorry?
You said a couple of things about wanting a spin 0 particle in the middle of a graviton, and I just wanted to
Oh, not in the middle. I want to scatter. I want incoming and outgoing spin zero particles.
Oh, to the intermediate particle.
The intermediate particle can be a graviton, and in fact is a graviton to get that amp. Not that that, you know, it's that diagram is pretty simple, even if it's a graviton. So.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you expect a whole lot of particles of these very high energies to be exchangeable? Lots of thresholds opening up.
Okay, this depends on your theory, of course. So in string theory, yes. And then that's supposed to come into using a souped-up graviton propagator here, which includes all that. However, it turns out that doesn't make a whole lot of difference.
At large impact parameter, you're dominated by the massless exchange.
Yeah, that's the reason.
And in gravity, you might say, well, gee, I have other massless things, photons, for example. But they're also working in the high energy limit, and there the coupling constant for the graviton is proportional to the energy. So its coupling is enhanced, but there's no such enhancement, say, for photons.
Yeah, but the massive particles don't matter much is that at small angles, this propagator, 1 over the propagator, which is 1 over whatever it's 1 over, is blowing up because whatever it's 1 over is going to 0 as the angle goes to 0. But that won't be true for massive things that are being exchanged. So the massless things dominate at small angles, which is why the answer doesn't matter very much on what happens at higher energies, and also why it's a tractable problem. Okay, so I've written a whole bunch of messy formulas on the board, and the thing we want to do is plug all these messy formulas into each other and come up with this partial wave amplitude. And for some reason, Musenich and Soldate never quite finished doing that in their paper. They sort of did half the calculation and then stopped. So we finished it. And the answer turns out to be, in the Iconal approximation, oh, and I should, well, let me finish this here. Okay, so the regime we're doing the calculation in is large impact parameter, which means large L. But we don't want to have so much energy that we're in the strong gravity regime. And that translates into the actual angular momentum being less than this critical angular momentum, which I guess has now been erased, but I will.
Actually, it's bigger, right?
Sorry?
Bigger. It's impact.
It's bigger. I'm sorry. This is the strong gravity regime, so I have this back. Right. Okay. So, right,
no,
for.
Much, much bigger.
Oh, sorry.
Something is forcing me to write it the wrong way around here. I've written it wrong three times now. So.
The big L is smaller than the small L, right?
Yeah, that must be it. Now, whose idea was it to call it? And let's see, there are corrections to this. It turns out that this is done, you get this result by doing some stationary phase calculation when you're doing some of these integrals. And the controlling parameter in that is what I've called epsilon here, which is the ratio of the critical angular momentum over the actual angular momentum, which is bigger than the critical angular momentum, power of d minus 3. So that's a small parameter. And this result is wrong, because if I come over here to the generic formula for F sub L, there's a 2 here, and there's no 2 here, which means this is generically too big. On the other hand, half of them are 0, which is also generically wrong, because there's no particular reason for the odd ones to be 0. Odd ones being 0 would follow from crossing symmetry between T and U in the Mandelstam variables, which is what you would get if you were scattering identical particles. But no one told us these particles are necessarily identical. And this explicitly does not include the cross diagrams where they cross over like that. So this is an artifact of the approximation. It's actually an artifact of the small angle approximation, because if I only know the right answer for small angles, I can't possibly tell you all the F sub L's, which is the Fourier transform. So because I only know it for small angles, that means I do not expect to get the fine structure in L right. I really only know some envelope function over a range of L's that's 1 over the smallest theta I'm allowed to consider. So the correct thing to do is to average these things. This is why blackboards are better than PowerPoint. And then, voila, it's miraculously unitary, and we get this answer. And in fact, if you track through all the horrible numerical factors and figure out what this amplitude actually is, it sits up here. This is, in fact, just the usual Coulomb amplitude. And so another way to say what the iconal approximation is doing for you, the Coulomb phase shift, which you get just to leading order when you do the Coulomb approximation. The iconal approximation is just unitarizing the Coulomb amplitude, which is just a tree-level process. So given a tree-level phase shift, you can just postulate that that's the exact phase shift that goes up in the exponent, and that turns out to be what the iconal approximation is doing here.
I mean, so typically when you scatter, I would have expected that you would radiate some, soft particles or something. So why is this unitary? What approximation?
Well, because we ignored that.
We just ignored it.
We can consider it, and so you could consider, radiating off an extra particle. And if you do that, what you find is that in the same regime where epsilon is small, you would get a contribution to beta, which corresponds to which is also small. And there's an estimate in the paper. And this morning I tried, without looking at the old notes, I tried to do it again, and I got a different answer. So I'm not going to write down the estimate from the paper, but Steve and I will duke it out after the talk. It's going to be small, and it's controlled by the same small parameter. That's that much I'm confident of.
But beta is 0 to first order. Is that?
Sorry?
Beta is 0 to first order.
Beta is 0 to first order.
But is a small parameter beta or epsilon? Because that's
epsilon.
Epsilon.
Well, epsilon is in some sense dual. L is dual to theta. Saying that theta is small, it's like saying that L is big. So, okay.
So there's no infrared divergence to worry about in terms of radiating these soft particles that makes beta large in some sense?
No, not in five or more dimensions.
Okay. In 4 dimensions, there would be.
In 4 dimensions, there would be. And you would have to. The amplitude doesn't actually exist, and blah, 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 which is yet another reason not to want to be in 4 dimensions. Okay, so coming over to this diagram, what we get in the iconal approximation is just that these phases are lying right on the circle near 0, and if we were to do allow the emission of other particles, this would then start bending inside to some extent. So we get that picture. Okay. All right. So all of this is completely standard, largely uninteresting results that really could have been written down in 1945. So now I want to come to the hard part, which is the strong gravity regime. And this was, thinking about this was for me anyway, inspired by a remark that Nimar Khani Hamed made when he was here this summer, that I actually didn't hear him make, but other people heard him make it, and I heard it secondhand, which was that we ought to be able to guess this amplitude, because just like Veneziano was able to guess the string amplitude, we should just guess it. Of course, Veneziano only guessed the tree amplitude, which in a sense is considerably easier. But anyway, so I think that's an interesting way to think about the problem. And if you're going to make a guess, you have to have some assumptions that go behind the guess. And the real issue is, can you make enough, can you come up with a list of reasonable assumptions? Of course, people can disagree on what's reasonable and what isn't, but come up with a list of reasonable assumptions that's actually restrictive enough to give you an answer, or give you some idea of the answer. And so that's what we think we've done. So let me list the assumptions. First of all, is that a black hole is formed basically with probability 1. If you're at sufficiently small impact parameter. And the argument for this is really the semi-classical argument that Steve mentioned earlier, and that goes back to his work of a few years ago also with Doug Eardley on forming trapped surfaces. If you scatter two classical particles, just two classical point particles in general relativity, and they are passing by each other with an impact parameter that's inside the Schwarzschild radius, they form a trapped surface and therefore a black hole. And that happens classically with probability 1. And so now you can imagine doing it quantum mechanically with two, say, Gaussian wave packets, and except for some very small tail of some probability distribution, you would expect to also form a black hole in that case. So that will be, anyway, that's going to be assumption 1. I think it is open to question. Next is, what is really the nature of quantum mechanical black holes? And so we're going to assume that a quantum black hole corresponds to an off-axis pole in scattering amplitude. So this is a very familiar notion from quantum mechanics or quantum field theory, where if you have an unstable particle, it's not really in the set of asymptotic states that you're allowed to scatter. You see it as a resonance in scattering amplitudes for particles that it can decay to. And so if you look at the scattering amplitude of some pair of particles into which the resonance could decay, and you look at the scattering amplitude, which you analytically continue to a complex S-plane, there would be a pole corresponding at a point corresponding to the mass of the resonance, and I think it's really supposed to be below the real axis in the standard convention, but never mind. There's the height above the real axis gives you the width of the resonance, which is 1 over the lifetime.
Would you expect to have any different black holes forming the spectrum of energies? Somehow will the particles go in if you go out?
Well, first of all, let's come back to black holes. I'm talking about, the Rho meson for the moment.
Well, the Rho meson has a definite energy.
Right, the Rho meson has a definite energy. Now, there are two aspects to your question. One is that there's a lot of black holes. Yeah. The other is we have the perennial worry of extra massless particles, which will really turn poles into cuts in this kind of thing. Okay, so I'm not going to worry about the latter because I don't think it's important. The Rho meson pole doesn't go away because there are photons that couple to the charged Rho mesons. It formally turns into a cut, but this is really irrelevant for basically all purposes. And so I'm not going to worry about the fact that these really are cuts, or branch points rather, where cuts begin. The other statement is that there are lots of black hole states. And that means there are lots of poles. Okay. And that's going to be very important. So there are lots of poles. And I personally believe they look like this.
Why not just a cut?
Because it's not a cut. Because it's there are lots of different black hole states. We know how many there are. Right?
Well, what I was referring to is that you would assume that if two black holes have essentially the same mass, that they would have essentially the same lifetime because we need to make one.
I don't see any reason to believe that's true, and I actually don't think it's true. My model for believing that it looks like this is chaotic scattering in various simple systems. So people have studied in, as some of you know, I spent a lot of time playing around with quantum chaos issues. People do, in chaos theory, study problems where you can send in some wave into some region where classically the particle would move chaotically and then watch things come out. And this is generally the pattern you get. You get a pattern of poles with a apparently random distribution of widths over some range. And again, as some of you know, I think quantum chaos is related to the reason why statistical mechanics actually works. And since black holes are thermal systems, I think they have to behave the same way. This isn't going to matter for anything I'm going to say shortly. But
do they all have the same negative momentum?
Yes, we should. And this is another reason for wanting to do things in the partial wave expansion with definite angular momentum, is we want to do this with definite angular momentum, and then this should be the appropriate Kerr black hole resonances that are sitting here.
Is there some like this region which the black holes don't penetrate?
I don't think so, but no one really knows.
So there should be black holes that are arbitrarily close to real axes?
I don't see why not. This isn't going to matter. But those would just be particular black hole states. Remember, there are a whole bunch of these. We're going to get to that in a minute. And if one of them happens to be very close, that one just decays really fast.
It's the other way around.
Oh, it's the other way around.
We know an example of those, right? Because we said the ones that decay back to the original two particles are
very, right. Very those are very long lived. But so that's the partial width. That's not the total width. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yes. Maybe it's cut off. I don't care. It's not going to matter. The important point. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry. But you're saying the mass of the black hole is a discrete. Is it quantized variable?
Yes. But it depends on what you mean by quantized. By quantized, you mean discrete. Yes, I'm saying there's a discrete set of poles here. Modulo this issue of extra massless particles turning the poles into branch points.
Okay,
I'm not sure who's supposed to talk yet. All right, so that these are, definite numbers. Right? And these are definite, These are some set of definite complex numbers.
Why are they discrete?
What else would they be?
What else does the Bekenstein-Hawking interface?
Yeah. What? All right. So
that's the entropy of a black hole with a given mass, but it's not telling you the mass of the black hole.
No, that's not what. Well, that's not what. In regular quantum systems, right, including gases and field theory and all that sort of thing, what the entropy actually counts is the density of states. And it actually counts a smooth density of states called rho, which then goes like, this is a function of the energy, it goes like e to the entropy. Okay. So if you have some standard statistical mechanical system, let's say, a bunch of atoms in a box that you could solve exactly, you would find that the exact energy eigenstates form some set of states on an energy axis. They would be a discrete set of states. They would be, if I have a gas in a box, I have discrete energy eigenvalues. But then I could count the number of states in some range, and I could talk about an average density of states that's smoothed over an energy scale that's very large compared to the mean level spacing, but very small compared to classical scales on which the energy varies. And then you again get a density of states, which is precisely what is the usual thermodynamic, E to the usual thermodynamic entropy. So that's how thermodynamic entropy works in real systems where we really know that thermodynamics works. And so I'm assuming it works the same way here.
We may or may not agree with string theory on various points, but anyone who is a string theorist should appreciate this point, because that's one thing that string theory claims to calculate in certain cases.
Right. So the the usual extremal black holes that turn into a collection of D-brains, this is exactly what you're doing. Is, of course, then they all pile up, but you're exactly counting the number of discrete quantum states. That,
the reason why I was pestering you about where there's a cut is that you're going to use ellipticity on the real axis. You have to have some room to maneuver. Because if everything starts touching the real axis, then you have infinite collection.
Well, I don't want it to touch the real axis. It definitely is not allowed to touch the real axis.
Right, but sometimes you need some uniform band.
Well, if I need one, then one must be there. The really important point, and this is one thing that's very special about black holes, is that this density of states is much, much larger than these widths. These widths are all controlled by the Schrodinger radius. The lifetime of a black hole is controlled by the Schrodinger radius, and that's... Sorry? What did I say? Schwarzschild. Too many S's. And entropy is S, and everything is S. Okay. The correct person whose name begins with S, radius, controls this width. And the really important point, or the point that we will need to make use of, is that this number is much. I mean, bigger or smaller can be much bigger than 1 over this number. That is, the spacing is much smaller than the width. Okay. So, if we go back to the simple picture of a Rho meson or something, let's suppose we just had a single isolated resonance. What happens when you have a single isolated resonance and you move past it in energy? Is that as you move past a resonance in energy, the corresponding phase shift changes by pi. Okay. That's what happens when you go by a pole. So in this case, you're now, and how fast you have to go by it, as E. E has to traverse a distance of order the width in order to go by this pole, in order to see this change. Okay. So now that you have a whole bunch of closely spaced resonances, you're now going by a whole bunch of them, and you're picking up a pi every time you go by each one.
This leads to an implausible result. And I'm going to ask, aren't there also zeros? Don't you actually pick up the number of poles minus the number of zeros? If I have two poles, there's probably a zero somewhere in between them, which gives the opposite phase. Because this is going to lead you to an implausible result.
What's the implausible result?
Well,
I don't think that's
really
true.
Huge, right?
I don't think that's true. Because the standard way of modeling this is just to say that the amplitude, the partial wave amplitude, this e to the 2i delta l. Can be modeled as simply a product over the resonances of. Well, I'm going to get the sign wrong in the imaginary part, but
this would have you
over. Right, but.
So this would have no zeros.
This has no zero.
Okay, I was thinking of a sum, which would have zeros.
No, it's a product, not a sum.
Okay.
And in fact, I know in non-relativistic potential scattering, you can prove that the amplitude always takes this form. Although I don't think anyone's ever done it for field theory. And of course, this is in field theory anyway. So.
Yeah, but in two dimensions, the formulas for variance and things look exactly like that also.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to, I don't know if this is, I guess I didn't write my third assumption. Oh, I get, well, I'm already really talking about my third assumption here, which is that the widths and branching ratios, that is, which particles you go to, are controlled by Hawking. That is, not by Stephen himself, but by the... by the Hawking evaporation process. Okay, well, which I've already said by writing this down here. Okay, so since delta, the phase shift changes by pi every time you pass a resonance, as you're going by here, you're passing by a whole bunch of resonances, you can just add them up. And, well, again, as we've said, this really depends, the density depends on angular momentum. I should have maybe put some angular momentum indices on here, too. So this is the entropy of the corresponding Kerr black hole with a mass given by the energy and the angular momentum given by the angular momentum. To leading order, you can do this integral because it's always dominated by the endpoint because s is always increasing. So this is again just e to the s here. Modulo, of course, subleading corrections, prefactors in the density of states, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that's the phase shift. Then we also expect that, in fact, a 2-to-2 scattering process doesn't happen very often, because if you actually form a big black hole, you expect it to Hawking evaporate into a zillion particles, not into two particles. So, so there's a thermal suppression of a two-body final state and that will contribute to this factor that's been named e to the minus 2 beta L. And well, actually, the thermal suppression will happen in the rate, not the amplitude. So the e to the minus 2 beta L is in the amplitude, so we square it to get the rate. And that should be e to the minus the change in entropy to go from the initial state to the final state. And the final state, because it's just two particles, basically has an entropy zero. So this should just be, again, the same entropy that sits up here. And these two estimates are actually consistent with each other in the following sense. This is something we worried about for a while, because for a while we thought there was an inconsistency, which is, one way to physically interpret a phase shift is to think of a real-time scattering process. And these widths, the width of the resonance up here, and which if you actually plotted the phase shift would do something like this over a width gamma here. These widths are inverse lifetimes, and that's because if you actually sent in a wave packet, it would go in and then kind of rattle around for that amount of time and then come out again. And this is related to the, you can define a lifetime, which is actually called the Wigner-Smith time delay, which tells you how old an idea it is, which is, oops, that's the wrong thing. That's just the derivative of the phase shift with energy, of course, evaluated at the resonant point. And since I told you the phase shift goes like e to the s, this would tell you, because differentiating it isn't going to change it, this would tell you the lifetime also goes like e to the s. And that sounds bad, because now the black hole suddenly has an exponentially large lifetime. But it's actually not, this is not giving you the black hole lifetime. This is giving you the inverse is not really the width. This is the partial width to go into that particular final state. And so we should multiply this lifetime by the probability that we actually go into this state, which is e to the minus s. So that, again, of course, to really check this, you'd have to get all the prefactors right. But the exponentials cancel in the appropriate way. So that we have this very rapidly changing phase shift is pretty much, it has to be accompanied by a big suppression of the elastic amplitude.
So just, I lose track of which, how to use partial widths and so forth. It is the story that this is the time that if we do a bunch of scatter experiments and select those where the black hole does decay back to the initial two particles, is that the typical lifetime?
The answer is either yes or no.
Right.
And I once spent an afternoon at my blackboard, you know, actually working through this thought experiment. You know, something decays and then you, yeah, okay. And the answer worked out to be the, you know, whatever makes you happy. But I can't remember whether it was yes or no right now.
I think you want to make me happy. I'm just...
Okay, well,
you're not sure.
I'm not sure. You have to. I did think it through carefully at one point because I was worried about this kind of thing myself and convinced myself that this was the correct thing. You have to. So you want to watch a whole bunch of. You have a whole bunch of black holes.
Yeah.
Most of them aren't decaying to two particles. You want to pick out the ones that do decay to two particles,
right.
And then histogram the one. All right. So now histogram how long it took the ones that only decayed to two particles to decay. And I can't remember whether the answer is exponentially long or not.
And two particles are probably equal mass, right?
Well, they have to be, right? Because the black hole is
the same initial two particles.
So this is the original two particles.
Well, I'm not. Well, now I'm just thinking of. Yeah. I'm just thinking of. I have a big ensemble of black holes, which I form them. I guess I have to form them. So I form them, and I wait for it to decay. The overwhelming majority, oops, decayed to more than two particles. I don't consider those.
I think it should match onto the usual partial width.
I think it matches on to the usual.
And you know, this is a rare event, so it doesn't happen very often.
That's but the question is, even though it's rare, is it also long? And I think the answer is it's not long, but I can't remember now.
That has no operational meaning.
Sorry?
That has no operational meaning.
Well, no, you have to do it many times, right? So you have 8 trillion black holes. Only a million of them decayed to two particles. You watch how long it took each of those million, how long it took before they decayed to two particles, and then you ask what was the average amount of time it took.
You certainly just naively extrapolating Hawking, which you take to control these decay widths, is going to be some long time, just like
Well, I'm not sure. But we can work it out, not in the next 1 minute, which is how much time I have left. Which is, well, just close to the right amount of time. Okay, so this is basically the story. This is, I've now told you alpha, I've told you delta, what delta L is and what beta L is. So this is our onsets for what the black hole scattering amplitude should look like. And if we go back and plug that in over here, the important point is that this e to the minus 2 beta L thing is really, really small. So it really doesn't matter very much what the deltas are, because this thing is so small that it's completely negligible compared to the 1, and you only have the 1. And then when you do this partial wave sum, you should, of course, stop at the critical angular momentum where we no longer believe you form a black hole and therefore no longer believe this story. And then after that, you should put in the iconal amplitude or the souped up iconal amplitude or something. But if you just put in the black holes up to L and then compute the total cross section, you get the you get something that has the right power of the Schwarzschild radius in it. Of course, we don't know if we get the prefactors right, but because that, you know, it will depend on exactly how this cutoff works at the critical angular momentum. But if you get T by summing up to L, and with, with e to the minus 2 beta L essentially equal to 0, and then compute the total cross-section, you get something that ends up going like the Schwarzschild radius to the d minus 2, which is, of course, the correct answer. In terms of energy, this goes like e to the d minus 2 over d minus 3. So it's rising with energy, and it is therefore rising as a power of the energy, and is therefore violating the Froissart bound, which says that cross sections can only rise as a power of the logarithm of the energy. On the other hand, the Froissart bound, to prove it, you're not allowed to have any massless particles around, and so we don't really expect it to hold anyway. But there are other interesting bounds one can talk about. One is the Cerullis-Martin bound. Which I admit I'd never heard of until Steve told me about it. Which is a lower bound on the scattering amplitude as a function of angle, and says that it has to be bigger than e to the minus some angle-dependent coefficient times e log e. And, you know, do you have a physical feeling for where this comes from?
Yeah, now I do. It's the tail of the diffractive peak.
Okay.
Which is why, I'll let you
get
the punchline.
Well, the punchline is one reads various obscure papers on properties of Gegenbauer polynomials and finds out that our amplitude satisfies this. So nothing interesting there, but, I don't know, I guess it depends on what.
Well, there's been some.
Some people have speculated that it should violate the.
Yes, including one in present company.
Oh.
Well, so
okay.
I now believe that's mistaken, but I believed that at one point.
Oh, okay. But I didn't realize you were among the apostates.
No. Well, yeah. So at one point I thought that was what's going on.
Why did you think it was?
Because I was confused. Let me just.
Okay.
We sorted that out.
Okay. Well, another bound that it does violate is it's not polynomial bounded. Now, polynomial boundedness is not something anyone proves. It's always an input. So, for example, to prove the Froissart bound, you assume the amplitude is polynomial bounded. And to look at polynomial boundedness, you take the amplitude as a function of S and T, you analytically continue to positive T, T is negative in the physical region, and our amplitude goes like, it's exponential in the square root of T, and that really just comes from the Gegenbauer polynomials, which at high L are basically just e to the I L theta with some funny stuff, and theta gets analytically continued to I theta when you continue T to negative to positive T, and so you get an exponential. And the usual polynomial boundedness assumption says that the amplitudes only grow as polynomials of T at fixed F. And this is growing faster than a polynomial of T. Now, no one ever proves polynomial boundedness. It's always an assumption. And the nature of the assumption is related to causality, because if you have something that goes exponentially like this, and you again imagine sending in wave packets, you can get wave packets that come out before they went in. And that's generally considered bad form. But it turns out that it's okay. There's a certain amount of coming out before you come in that's okay, because suppose you have some scattering region here of radius r. So there's some which we will of course take to be the Schwarzschild radius. Now suppose you send in a particle and it bounces off like this. Okay. Well, you now lost some time here because it didn't actually go in here and come all the way back. It bounced off here. So you're allowed to have some waves come out, some scattered waves are allowed to come out a little early as long as the amount they come out early is related to this distance here. Okay. And so this early distance is basically r sine theta or theta over 2. Now I'm confused. I think it's theta over 2. Which, you know, is, and sine theta over 2 is exactly the square root of t. So it turns, more or less. So it turns out that this exponent gives you waves that come out too early, but they only come out too early by this amount which they're allowed to come out by. And so it's not polynomial bounded, but the underlying reason for assuming polynomial boundedness, which is causality, is still okay.
Mark, I thought the polynomial boundedness came from relativity.
This isn't a field theory, so.
Yeah, but I thought that's why people actually put it.
No. Polynomial boundedness came from days when people thought field theory was the spawn of the devil. And they're satisfied in electromagnetism, I believe.
So what's so special about gravity? A lot of stuff.
It's the long range. This effective range is getting big.
Yeah, it's that the range is growing with energy, I think.
The range of the force from the change is
the coupling constant is growing.
Coupling constant.
Well,
remember this.
Where there's strong deflection is getting big. Range where the absorption is important, for example, is getting large. For example, you can quantify that in terms of this maximum angular momentum, which grows as a power of energy. And field theory doesn't, for example, things that obey the Froissart bound, and there are these kind of marginal cases like QED, which.
What was my question? What was it?
I think in QED, it's a scaling man theory that the mean then is not an issue because the L, you never get a different, you don't get this bounding L. L is always fixed.
Well, it's very, you know, this is not, you know, graviton exchange in any sense. This is saying the absorption, you know, everything that can get absorbed is absorbed. In QED, that's not going to happen. You're going to have every photon is going to pay a power of alpha, and so it's going to be quite different. Okay, so that's basically everything I wanted to say, except let me conclude with open questions. Of course, the big one is, what is really the status of these assumptions? And whether we agree with them or disagree with them, can we do anything to prove them or to improve evidence for them? Don't have anything in particular to say about that. Another question is, I drew this Argand diagram. I put the iconal part. The strong black hole part is a tight spiral that fits right around here, except I'm drawing it the wrong way. I want to draw it this way. Okay, and it has a radius that goes like the angle to the minus 1/2. That comes, well, you know, delta gives you the angle, beta gives you the radius, and this is what it works out to be. And so this is a very small radius. This is this e to the minus s radius. Then there's this big question mark of what happens in between. Does it just nicely, smoothly move over? Does it do some backflips? What does it do? know, in a sense, you think, well, there's the weak coupling regime and the strong coupling regime, and then there's some small intermediate coupling regime. But on this diagram, the intermediate coupling regime is the whole thing, because the strong coupling regime is a tiny spiral in the middle, and the weak coupling is tracking the edge very closely, and what happens in the middle is a big open question. Another open question is, one thing the partial wave expansion is very bad at is crossing symmetry. That is, you would expect, again, in an analytically continued S&T plane, you would expect the amplitudes to be equal. But there's really nothing you can do to test that when you only have a series. You really need to be able to sum it up. And of course, we don't know how to sum it up. So.
Doesn't this get more complicated because you have an infinite number of poles that are very dense? And you're supposed to replace them by something else.
Well, OK, so Steve likes to speculate that maybe crossing symmetry does not actually hold in quantum gravity. maybe like is too strong a word.
That's a strong version.
Okay.
At least the usual arguments for crossing symmetry appear in jeopardy as a virtue, because of the cuts and so on. And so there is a question, I think, a valid question, why do we expect crossing symmetry to hold? I don't know the answer.
I thought the usual answer is because Euclidean confirmation would tell you that that's what you should have.
Well, I think you have to, there's an issue, the usual story, I think, gets complicated by these cuts, right? Often what you'll do is you'll continue through the gap in the cuts, say in the S plane or whatever, and that's how you can show crossing. But then if the cuts are all the way down to the origin, you can't continue through them so easily.
But this is also true in QED, and somehow
yeah, so
it doesn't matter.
There's a question of.
You might want to say that the fact that no space terms cannot be analytically continued tells you that gravity shouldn't be followed in the same terms as field theory, where we usually do the analytical continuation because space time is a background.
That's another possible clue, but.
My attitude is, if it would be really nice if you could use crossing symmetry to help validate or improve or something this picture. And so, I wish I knew how to do that. I don't. But if it's not even true, then it's not going to be definitely not going to be useful. So I would really like it to be true, because then it would be a tool we could use to, at least in principle, help improve things. Okay.
So you have a lot of room in these.
Lots of room in the.
Enough room to violate some of your. Conclusions about bounds, if you include those terms?
Probably not. Again, it's hard to make a definitive statement. But so you're summing up this series, and we think we know what happens up to a number of order L, that this is basically 1 or I over 2 or whatever it's supposed to be. And then these other things could turn on. It's hard to see how they could undo this behavior, because basically, every term in here in these things is behaving that way, and it's and when you know you're you've got this list that all comes in at the same amplitude at the beginning, it's hard to see how the later ones could turn it off. But
most of these conclusions come from the -1 and not
yep.
the so the,
yep,
the real,
absolutely.
Real black hole-y part somehow, or where the guts of the black hole is, and all of the states. Is not really
right. Exactly.
Easy to latch onto.
Right. So at least when I first started thinking about this, I was thinking focused on the deltas.
Right.
But it turns out we don't really care about the deltas because they're completely swamped by the betas. And this is something you could say with this is just something. This applies whenever you believe that the two-body final state has a small branching ratio. Mm-hmm. And the other important thing is. Up to what L is that true? Because the value of the critical L and its dependence on the energy, that's what gives you the correct Schwarzschild cross-section, for example.
You can think of this as being due to the -1, roughly. There's another way to write it as well, where it's not relying on the -1. But the physical statement is that absorption is big out to large L.
Yeah.
And that L, where it's big out to, grows as a power of the energy.
And that's rare. Usually absorption falls off with large L. or, you know, it falls off as a power of L or something like that.
When you prove the Froissart bound, for example, the first thing you do is basically you show that scattering is not important beyond some L that goes like the log of the other game.
Right.
So.
Okay, well, I have a couple of questions, but it's getting late, so maybe I'll just ask one. I mean, it seems to me very likely that your two curves will just match up very quickly. I mean, there was an analogous, well, not analogous, there was a problem discussed next door in this numerical relativity thing in which it had the same character. Of course, all the details are different, but they're doing the binary black hole problem. And what they know, of course, is that in the in-spiral, there's a certain frequency associated with the orbital frequency. After the guys coalesce, there's another frequency associated with the ring down, these quasi-normal mode frequencies. And those are very different. So they've now got the whole waveform from the numerical, you know, evolution, and they can plot frequency as a function of time. And what they should see is the frequency during the in-spiral grows very slowly, and then the whole thing coalesces, and it jumps very quickly to the quasi-normal mode frequency, and the radiation stays there for a while.
Well, I certainly, you know, I think the physics of it is really, I mean, this is sort of a, you know, the list of assumptions was really pretty much independent of your theory of quantum gravity, right? It just depended on general properties of quantum black holes that I think most people in the room would agree are likely to be true. So you could imagine that how this fills in, and I think this is actually right, depends a lot on what the actual theory is. And in particular, you know, in the string calculations, you know, various string substructures are excited and, you know, complicated string patterns can appear. And if you have a whole bunch of complicated stuff that can happen as you go from the simple Coulomb biconal scattering to full-form black hole scattering, if you can be making all kinds of complicated stuff as you make that transition, then all kinds of complicated things might happen here. On the other hand, if it's just some nice, simple, smooth thing, then it's probably...
That's sort of the point. In the super Planckian regime, you wouldn't really expect to make all that complicated stringy stuff before you make a black hole.
Right, exactly, right. Which is why we think we can actually draw this spiral here and have some confidence that it's right. And that it doesn't matter what your theory of quantum gravity is. Okay, thank you very much.
Good job.